Chapter 37. The wind off the Pacific bumped the water on the lake into a mild chop. Though the lake was large, the tide was minimal, and the temperature was a mild 80 degrees. The silence over the dark waters was fractured by the harsh whir of a jet ski's motor. Unseen by human eyes, it raced through the night at a speed of over 50 knots, invisible to radar because of a soft rubber mantle that absorbed the radio wave pulse and stopped the echo from returning to the radar's transmitter. Pitt steered the Polaris Virage TX with Giordino on the rear seat and a bag full of equipment in the bow storage. Along with their dive gear, they also carried their stolen Odyssey employee jumpsuits, except this time the photos on the IDs matched their faces, with Giordino's features retouched to at least resemble a husky woman. While waiting for their dive gear to be flown in from Washington, they had gone to a photo shop and arranged for their pictures to be taken and reinserted inside the laminated plastic ID holders. The shop's owner charged them a pretty price, but asked no questions. As they rounded the shoreline below the Madeira volcano side of the island, they skirted the isthmus, staying a mile off a sandy beach that stretched between the two mountains. The lights of the complex shone brightly against the black of Mount Concepcion. No blackout here. The Odyssey management felt safe and snug, guarded by their army of security agents and array of detection equipment. Pitt slowed the jet ski as they approached the dock area, where a large Costco container ship was brightly lit under a sea of floodlights. Pitt noted that the cranes were offloading the cargo containers onto trucks parked beneath the hull. No cargo was going on. He began to think the complex was more than a research and development center. It had to have a connection with the tunnels that ran under it. Sandecker had finally agreed on the mission in principle. Jaeger and Gunn had filled Pitt and Giordino in on the purpose of the tunnels. It then became imperative in everyone's mind that whatever information they gained inside the complex might be vital for the discovery of Spectre's motives for covering Europe in ice. The Virage TX was painted a charcoal gray that blended into the black water. Contrary to what is shown in the movies, where agents sneak around in black skin-tight suits, dark gray has less visibility under the stars at night. The three-cylinder engine was massaged by Numa engineers to put out 170 horsepower. Noise reduction was also modified to reduce exhaust noise by 90%. Speeding across the black water, the only sounds came from the slap of the bow and the muted hum of the tuned pipe exhaust. They had reached the outer edge of the Isle de Ometepe in half an hour after leaving a deserted wharf south of Grenada. Pitt eased back on the throttle as Giordino studied a basic handheld radar detector. "How's it look?" Pitt asked. "Their beam sweeps past us without pausing, so they must not be reading us." "We were wise to take the precaution of finishing the trip underwater," Pitt said, tipping his head toward a pair of searchlights that were sweeping the water for 500 yards off the shore. "I make it about a quarter of a mile. Our depth sounder reads the bottom at only 22 feet. We must be out of the main channel." "Time to abandon ship and get wet," Giordino said, motioning toward a patrol boat that appeared around the end of a long dock. Already in their light wetsuits, they quickly pulled their dive gear and packs from the jet ski's storage areas. The Virage was a stable craft, and they could stand while helping each other slip into their oxygen closed-circuit rebreathers, of a type used by the military for shallow water operations. After quickly going through the pre-dive checking procedures, Giordino slid into the water while Pitt tied the hand grips in a straight position. Then he aimed the jet ski on a course toward the west shore of the lake and set the throttle as he slid off. Neither man took a backward glance at the speeding craft before diving beneath the surface. Though they were using communication equipment, they took no chances of losing each other in the ink-black water. They clipped the ends of a 10-foot line to their weight belts. Pitt preferred the oxygen closed-circuit rebreather. The semi-closed-circuit rebreathers were more efficient for deep-water work, but they left telltale signs of bubbles on the surface. Breathing 100% oxygen, the rebreather was the only true bubble-free diving system, the reason they were used by military divers on covert missions. There could be no detection on the surface because the system eliminated all indications of bubble exhaust. It took specialized training to use the system efficiently without problems, but Pitt and Giordino were no strangers to rebreathers, having used them for 20 years. Neither man spoke. Giordino trailed behind, tracing Pitt's movement by using a shaded underwater penlight that sent out a thin beam that was next to impossible to spot from the surface. Pitt saw the bottom slope down as they came to the main ship channel. He leveled off, checked his compass, and began kicking toward the Odyssey dock. Far into the distance, magnified by the water, he and Giordino could hear the thrash of the patrol boat's twin screws. Relying on his compass and computer displaying GPS positions, they homed in on the section under the main dock where it met the shoreline. They swam slowly and steadily, seeing the water on the surface become a shade less black as they came closer to the lights beaming over the entire dock area. They could also see the sweep of the searchlights as their yellow shafts streaked across the surface above them. The water became more transparent, and they began to see the yellow glow turn brighter on the water surface. Another 100 yards, and they could make out the faintly shimmering outline of the dock pilings. They skirted around the big Costco container ship, staying far enough away so no idle crewman could see them under the surface. All activity had come to a standstill on the dock. The big cranes became immobile, and the warehouses were closed and deserted as the trucks moved away. Suddenly, Pitt felt the back of his neck tingle, and he sensed a movement in the water as a huge shape materialized out of the gloom and swiped Pitt's shoulder with its tail and disappeared. He stiffened, and Giordino immediately sensed the rope go slack. "What is it?" Giordino demanded. "I think we're being stalked by a Carcharonid." "A shark?" "A Lake Nicaragua bull shark with blunt-nosed snout, big and gray, 8 to 9 feet." "Do freshwater sharks bite?" "Show me one who isn't carnivorous." Pitt swept the narrow beam of the penlight in a circle, but it failed to pierce the murky water for more than 10 feet. "We'd better circle the wagons." Giordino swiftly picked up on the meaning and swam to Pitt's side and turned until they were back to back, facing in opposite directions to cover 360 degrees. As if reading the other's thoughts, they pulled their dive knives from the sheaths attached to their lower legs and held them as if pointing swords. Their nemesis returned and slowly spiraled around them, moving closer with each circle. Its gray skin was ominously illuminated under the tiny glow of their penlights, a big, repulsive beast staring at them from one black eye as large as the rim on a coffee cup, with a wide jaw showing triangular rows of serrated teeth like a snarling dog. It turned sharply and eased past the divers for a closer look, never having seen such strange fish with appendages that did not resemble its usual victims. It had the look of a gluttonous monster trying to make up its mind whether the two weird fish that had intruded into its domain would make a palatable meal. It seemed curious that its prey made no move to dart away. Pitt knew the sinister murder machine was not quite ready to attack. The mouth was only slightly open and the lips had not pulled away from the hideous teeth. He decided that offense was the best defense, and he lunged at the creature, thrusting his knife and making a slashing swipe across the shark's nose, the only tender spot on its taut body. The shark rolled away, trailing a streak of blood, confused and angered by the sudden show of resistance from what should have been an easy kill. Then it turned, hovered for a few moments, flipped its tail fins, and came at them with phenomenal speed in a movement dead silent, straight for the kill. Pitt had only one trick left in his bag. He shined the beam of the penlight directly into the shark's right eye. The unexpected flash temporarily blinded the killer just enough to induce it to veer and roll to his right, mouth opening in anticipation of biting into flesh and bone. Pitt kicked fiercely, twisting his body to one side as the shark flashed past, using its pectoral fin to push it away. The yawning jaws clamped shut on empty water. Then Pitt lashed out with the knife and gashed the monster in its black, lifeless eye. Two things could have happened. The maddened shark could have attacked without further hesitation, provoked by pain and anger, or it could have swum away, half-blinded, giving up the battle for easier prey. Fortunately, it swam away and did not return. "That was about as close as we ever came to being a special on a dinner menu," Giordino said in a vague tone still tinged with tension. "He would probably have digested me and spit you out for tasting bad," Pitt came back. "We'll never know whether he enjoyed Italian food. Let's get a move on before one of his pals comes nosing around." They continued on, but with greater caution than before, feeling a sense of relief as the light from the docks now provided them with a good 30 feet of underwater visibility. Finally, they reached the pilings under the dock and swam between them before surfacing and staring up at the wooden planking, where they floated, getting their wind and waiting to see if they had set off any security sensors. After a few minutes, no sounds of approaching security guards were heard from above. Pitt said, "We'll follow the dock until it reaches the shore before we surface again." This time, Jordina moved off into the lead, with Pitt following. The bottom came up sharply, and they were relieved to find a sandy beach free of rocks. Crouching under the dock and shielded from the overhead lights, they removed their dive gear and wetsuits, opened their waterproof bags, and retrieved their Odyssey jumpsuits and hard hats. Slipping on socks and shoes, they checked their ID badges to see they were attached in the proper position before stepping warily into the open. A single guard sat in a small house at the edge of a paved road that passed by the entrance to the dock. He was eyeballing a TV channel that was running an old American movie in Spanish. Pitt scanned the area but saw only the single guard. "Shall we test our presence?" he said to Jordina, face to face for the first time since they dove in the water. "You want to observe his reaction when we walk by?" "Now or never, to see if we can freely move throughout the facility." They walked casually past the guardhouse. The security guard, wearing the male black jumpsuit, caught their movement and came out onto the road. "La Parada!" he shouted, a frown on his face. "La Parada?" Jordina repeated. "It means halt." "¿Qué es hacer de ti aquí? Usted debe estar en los cuartos." "Here's your chance to flash your Spanish," said Jordina, his fingers tightening around the grip of his gun beneath the jumpsuit. "What Spanish?" said Pitt benignly. "I forgot most of what I learned in high school." "Take a guess. What did he say?" "He wants to know what we're doing here." Then he said, "We're supposed to be in our quarters." "Not bad," Jordina grinned. He walked up to the guard as if he didn't have a care in the world. "Yo no hablo el español," he said in a high-pitched voice in a sad attempt to mimic a woman. "Very good," Pitt complimented him in turn. "I've been to Tijuana." Jordino approached the guard and shrugged helplessly. "We're Canadian." The guard frowned as he looked at Jordino. If his mind could be read, it would reveal that the woman inside the white uniform jumpsuit was the ugliest he'd ever seen. Then his frown turned to a smile. "Oh, see, Canadians. I speak English." He pronounced it Inglés. "I know we're supposed to be in the barracks," said Pitt, smiling back. "We only wanted to take a little walk before going to sleep." "No, no, that is not allowed, amigos," said the guard. "You are not allowed out of your assigned area until after 8 o'clock. Pitt threw up his hands. "Sorry, amigo. We were talking and didn't notice we had wandered into the wrong area. Now we're lost. Can you direct us to the barracks?" The guard came over and shined a flashlight on their badges and studied them. "You from the dig?" "Sí, we're from the dig. Our superior sent us topside for a few days' rest." "I understand, senor, but you must return to your quarters. It is regulations. Just follow the road and turn left at the water tower. Your building is 30 meters to the left." "Gracias, amigo," said Pitt. "We're on our way." Satisfied Pitt and Jordino were not intruders, the guard returned to his little house. Jordino said, "Well, we passed the first test. Best we hide out somewhere until daylight. Not healthy to wander around here in the dead of night. Too suspicious. The next guard who stops us might not be so friendly." They followed the guard's directions until they came to a long row of buildings. They moved in the shadows through the edge of a grove of palm trees, studying the entrances to the living quarters for the employees of Odyssey. All but the fifth and last building were free of guards. That building had two guards stationed at the entrance, while another two patrolled the perimeter outside a high surrounding fence. "Whoever lives there must not be popular with Odyssey," said Pitt. "It looks like a prison." "The occupants must be held captive." "Agreed." "Then we break into one that's open." Pitt shook his head. "No, we enter this one. I want to talk to those who were held inside. We may learn more from them about Odyssey's operation." "No way we're going to bluff our way in." "Looks like a small shed next door. Let's move around, keeping the trees as cover, and check it out." You never take the easy path, Giordino groaned at seeing that Pitt's face held a remote and thoughtful expression under the glow of the lights lining the street. No fun if it's simple, Pitt said seriously. Like burglars slinking through a residential neighborhood, they moved through the trees, taking advantage of the thin, curling trunks until they reached the edge of the grove. Crouched and running, they covered another 30 yards until they reached the rear of the shed. Edging around one corner, they found a side door. Giordino tried the latch. It was open, and they slipped inside. Flashing their penlights around the interior, they found that it was an equipment garage that held a street sweeper. Pitt could see Giordino's teeth spread in a smile in the dim light. I think we struck the mother lode. Are you thinking what I'm thinking? I am, said Pitt. We start up the sweeper and send it down the street, but with one refinement to get the guard's attention. Which is? We set it on fire. Your devious mind never ceases to amaze me. It's a gift. In 10 minutes, they had siphoned 3 gallons of gas into a 5-gallon can they found in the garage. Pitt climbed into the cab of the street sweeper and turned on the ignition, while Giordino stood ready to swing the doors open. They were both thankful the engine started with a single cough and turned over smoothly without an abundance of exhaust noise. The sweeper had standard 4-speed transmission, and he stood outside the open door, ready to shift it into second gear, skipping first so the big vehicle would gain speed faster. Waiting until the last minute to avoid an explosion inside the garage from the gas fumes, he turned the steering wheel of the big vehicle so that it would angle down the road toward a row of parked trucks. Giordino opened the double doors and trotted back to the fuel can. He doused the gas into the empty cab and stood holding the flame starter for an acetylene torch. Showtime, he said briefly. Pitt, standing on the doorframe just outside the cab, jammed the shifter into gear and leaped as Giordino turned the oxygen and acetylene valves full open and squeezed the handle of the flame starter, sending a 2-foot flame bursting from the tip of the torch. There was a loud whoosh as a combustion-produced ball of fire enveloped the cab of the sweeper before it accelerated through the doors. Roaring down the road like a comet, the sweeper, with its brushes spinning wildly and throwing up a cloud of dirt and dust, sped 50 yards before crashing into the first truck and sending it bouncing on all wheels into a palm tree. Then it smashed square into the next truck in the row with a horrendous screech of tearing metal and glass, shoving it into the others until it finally became jammed and came to a standstill, with flames shooting into the sky, followed by a swirling cloud of black smoke. The 2 guards outside the building stood frozen in shock, staring incredulously at the sudden eruption of fire. Finally, they were galvanized into action, their first reaction being the obvious conclusion that the driver was still in the cab. They abandoned their posts and went running down the road, followed on their heels by the guards from inside. Pitt and Giordino took immediate advantage of the commotion focused around the blazing sweeper. Pitt dashed through the gated fence, dove inside the open door of the building, and fell on the floor, only to have Giordino, unable to stop his momentum, trip and fall on him. You've got to lose weight, Pitt grunted. Giordino swiftly pulled him to his feet. Now where, genius? Pitt didn't answer, but seeing that it was clear, he took off running down a long hallway. The doors on either side had locked latches. He stopped in front of the 3rd door and turned to Giordino. This is your specialty, he said, stepping aside. Giordino shot him a testy look, then leaned back and kicked the door half off its hinges. Then he lunged with one shoulder and finished the job. Unable to withstand the muscular Italian's onslaught, the door fell flat on the floor with a loud thud. Pitt stepped inside and found a man and a woman sitting upright in bed, frozen in shocked silence at the sight of the strangers, their faces expressing icy fear. Forgive the intrusion, Pitt said softly, but we need a place to hide. As he spoke, Giordino was already setting the door back in place. Where are you going to take us? The woman asked in near panic, with a heavy German guttural accent as she pulled up the covers around the top of her nightgown. Round, flushed face with wide brown eyes, silver hair pulled back in a bun, she looked like the grandmother she probably was. Though it was buried under a sheet and light blanket, Pitt could see that her body would never fit into a size 16 dress. No place. We're not who you think.
But you're one of them.
No, ma'am, said Pitt, trying to ease her terror. We are not employees of Odyssey. Then who in God's name are you? Asked the man, slowly recovering. The man in the bed rose in an old-fashioned nightshirt and threw on an equally old-fashioned chenille bathrobe. Just the opposite of what Pitt assumed was his wife, he was quite tall and thin as a yardstick. His thick gray hair stood at least 3 inches above Pitt's. White facial skin, a sharp pyramid of a nose, and tight lips decorated with a pencil-thin mustache defined his face. My name is Dirk Pitt. My friend is Al Giordino. We work for the United States government and are here to learn why the existence of this facility is such a well-guarded secret.
How did you get on the island? Asked the woman.
From the water, Pitt replied, without detail. We entered your building after creating a little diversion that drew away the guards. As he spoke, the sound of approaching sirens could be heard echoing down the corridor through the building's still open front entrance. I've never known anyone who could ignore watching a good fire.
Why did you choose our room?
Pure chance, nothing more. If you will kindly oblige us, said Giordino, we'd like to spend the night. We'll be gone come the dawn. The woman studied Giordino, her eyes traveling up and down his white jumpsuit with a look of suspicion.
You're not a woman.
Giordino responded with a wide smile. Thankfully, no. But how I came to be in a female Odyssey uniform is a long and boring story.
Why should we believe you?
I can't give you a reason in the world.
Do you mind telling us why you're confined inside this building? Queried Pitt.
Forgive us, said the woman, coming back on track. My husband and I are terribly confused. He is Dr. Klaus Löwenhardt, and I am his wife, Dr. Hilda Löwenhardt. We are only locked in at night. During the day, we work under heavy guard in the laboratories.
Pitt was amused at the formality of the introductions. How did you come to be here?
We were doing research at the Technical Research Institution in Aachen, Germany, when agents working for a Mr. Spectre representing the Odyssey Corporation requested that we come to work for them as consultants. My wife and I were only 2 out of 40 of the top scientists in our field who were lured away from their laboratories by offers of an immense amount of money and promises of funding for our projects after we were finished here and returned home. We were told we were flying to Canada, but they lied. When our plane landed, we found ourselves on this island in the middle of nowhere. Since then, we have all virtually worked as slaves.
How long ago?
5 years.
What type of research were you forced to conduct?
Our academic discipline is in the science of fuel cell energy.
Is this why this facility was constructed? To conduct experiments on fuel cells?
Löwenhardt nodded. Odyssey began construction nearly 6 years ago.
What about outside contact?
We are not allowed telephone communications with our friends and families, replied Hilda. Only outgoing letters, which are heavily censored.
5 years is a long time to be away from your loved ones. Why didn't you obstruct the research by slowdowns and sabotage?
Hilda shook her head solemnly. Because they threatened a horrible death to anyone who hampered the research.
And the lives of our families back home as well, added Klaus. We had no choice but to put forth a dedicated effort.
We also had a true desire to continue our life's work, to create a clean and efficient energy source for the people of the world.
One man who had no family, was made an example, said Hilda. They tortured him by night and forced him to work by day. He was found one morning hanging from the light fixture in his room.
We all knew he was murdered.
You believe he was murdered on orders from Odyssey officials?
Executed, Löwenhardt corrected him.
He smiled grimly and pointed up at the ceiling.
Look for yourself, Mr. Pitt. Would that fixture, which is little more than a wire and light bulb, support the weight of a man?
I see your point, Pitt acknowledged.
We do what we are told to do, said Hilda quietly. Whatever it takes to prevent harm from coming to our son and 2 daughters and 5 grandchildren. The others are in the same boat.
Have you and your fellow scientists made any progress in developing fuel cell technology? Asked Pitt. Hilda and Klaus turned and faced each other with quizzical expressions. Then Klaus said,
Hasn't the world learned of our success?
Success?
Along with our fellow scientists, We have developed an energy-generating source that combines nitrogen-producing ammonia and oxygen out of the atmosphere to create substantial amounts of electricity at a very low cost per unit, with pure water as its only waste product.
I thought practical and efficient fuel cells were decades away, said Giordino.
Fuel cells using hydrogen and oxygen to produce electricity, yes. Oxygen can come from the air. However, hydrogen is not readily available and must be stored as a fuel. But because of our fortunate and almost miraculous breakthrough, we have paved the way to non-polluting energy that is available to millions of people as we speak.
You talk as if it is already in production, said Giordino.
It was perfected and tested with great success over a year ago. Lovenhart gave him the look of a man staring at a village idiot. Production began immediately after it was perfected. Surely you're familiar with it.
They could read the expression of bafflement and incomprehension on Pitt and Giordino's faces as genuine. That's news to us, said Pitt skeptically. I'm not aware of a new miracle energy product sitting on store shelves or powering automobiles.
Nor I, Giordino chimed in.
We don't understand. We were told that millions of units had already been produced by a manufacturing facility in China.
Sorry to disappoint you, but your great achievement is still a secret, Pitt said sympathetically. I can only guess that the Chinese are stockpiling your creation for some inexplicable purpose.
But what do they have to do with the tunnels? Giordino muttered, confused at trying to put two and two together.
Pitt sat down in a chair and stared thoughtfully at the design in a throw rug. Finally, he looked up. The Admiral said that Jaeger's computer concluded that the purpose behind the tunnels was to lower the temperature of the Gulf Stream and throw the eastern United States and Europe into 8 months of frigid weather. Then he turned to the Lovenharts. Your cutting-edge power technology. Is it designed for automobiles?
Not at the moment. But eventually, with more study and refinement, it will generate enough clean energy to power all vehicles, including aircraft and trains. We've gone beyond the design stage. Currently, we're working out the final phase of engineering before running tests.
What does the gadget in production accomplish? Asked Pitt. Klaus winced at the word gadget.
The Maka is a self-sustaining generator that can provide cost-efficient electrical energy to every home, office, workplace, and school in the world. It makes air pollution a nightmare of the past. Now a family home, no matter how large or small, located in the city or in the farthest reaches of the country, can have its own independent source of energy.
You call it the Maka?
Spectre came up with the name himself when he saw the first operational unit. Maka, so he informed us, was the Celtic goddess of cunning, also known as the Queen of Phantoms.
The Celts again, muttered Giordino. The plot thickens, Pitt said philosophically.
Guard approaching warned Giordino at his station by the door. Sounds like two of them.
He leaned his weight against it.
The room became so hushed that the guards' voices became quite audible as they approached down the hallway, checking the doors of the hostage scientists. Their footsteps stopped outside. The Lovenhart's eyes took on the look of frightened rabbits hearing the howl of coyotes until they saw Pitt and Giordino's automatics appear as if by magic, and they realized these were men who had command of the situation.
Esta puerta parece dañada.
He said, the door looks damaged, Pitt whispered.
One of the guards jiggled the latch and pushed against the door, but it did not move with Giordino's weight against it.
Se parece seguro, came another voice.
It seems secure, Pitt translated.
Lo tendremos reparados por la mañana.
They said they'll have it repaired in the morning. Then the footsteps and voices faded as they continued on their rounds down the hallway.
Pitt turned and gave the Lowenharts a long, hard look. We're going to have to leave the island, and you must come with us.
You think that's wise? Giordino put to him.
Expedient, said Pitt. These people are the key to the mystery. Because of what they know, we don't have to take the chance of getting caught while we nose around the facility, nor would we learn a third of what the good doctors know.
No, no, Hilda gasped. We don't dare leave. Once security learns we were missing, the fiends at Odyssey will retaliate and murder our children.
Pitt took her hand and gently squeezed it. Your family will be protected. I promise you, no harm will be allowed to come to them.
I'm still not sure, Giordino said, considering the circumstances and possible consequences. Once we abandoned the jet ski, our only plan for escaping the island was to attempt to steal a boat or an airplane, since their security forces would stop any helicopter pickup. That plan won't come easy with a pair of senior citizens in tow.
Pitt turned back to the Lovenhearts. What you haven't considered is that when your usefulness is over, you and the other hostage scientists will have to be eliminated. Spectre cannot risk any of you revealing to the world what went on here.
Total understanding flooded Klaus Lovenhard's face, but he still could not bring himself to fully accept Pitt's words.
Not all of us. It's diabolical. They wouldn't dare kill us all. The outside world would discover the truth.
Not if a plane carrying you back to your homes mysteriously crashed in the sea. Except for an investigation into the crash, no one would be the wiser about what really happened.
Klaus looked at his wife and placed an arm around her shoulders.
I'm afraid Mr. Pitt is right. Spectre could not allow any of us to live.
Once you reveal everything to the news media, Spectre would not dare kill the other members of your scientific team. Every law enforcement agency of your respective countries would band together and go after Spectre and his Odyssey Empire with every international legal means at their disposal. Believe me, leaving now and coming with us is the only way.
Can you guarantee that you'll get us off the island safely? Asked Hilda hesitantly.
Pitt looked singularly concerned.
I can't promise what I can't predict with certainty. That you will surely die if you remain here.
Klaus squeezed his wife's shoulder.
Well, Mother, this looks like our chance to see our loved ones again.
She lifted her head and kissed him on the cheek.
Then we go together.
They're coming back, announced Giordino with his ear to the door.
If you will kindly get dressed, said Pitt to the Lovenhearts, my friend and I will take care of the guards.
Then he turned his back as the scientists began getting their clothes and joined Giordino on the opposite side of the door, Colt 45 drawn and held at the ready. The seconds ticked off as the guards retraced their steps. Pitt and Giordino waited patiently until the sound of the guards came outside the door. Then Giordino yanked the broken door inward, sending it crashing to the floor. The security guards were too surprised to offer resistance as they were pulled into the room and found themselves staring into the muzzles of two very large automatic pistols.
En el piso, rápidamente,
Pitt snapped, ordering them to lie on the floor as Giordino began tearing up the bedsheets. They quickly disarmed, bound, and gagged the stunned guards. 5 minutes later, Pitt, with Klaus and Hilda behind and Giordino bringing up the rear, passed through the entrance of the unguarded gate in the fence and scurried across the street that was packed with a milling crowd of security personnel and firemen surrounding the still-burning street sweeper before slipping into the shadows unnoticed.